I had such a splitting headache yesterday that if I was no more clear to many of you than I was to myself, I must have sowed a great deal of confusion. But I have no such excuse this morning. There's a story of a Church of England bishop who was invited over here to the States. He was warned that the American reporters were not so squeamish as some of the European ones, and he was coached by his press secretary before he landed at JFK. The press conference, the first one he had, went extremely well, until suddenly a Brooklyn reporter hopped up at the last moment and said, "Would the bishop be visiting the New York massage parlors?" Well coached, the bishop just looked at the man and said, "Are there such things in New York?" Everyone applauded, and the bishop's press secretary congratulated him on skillfully handling the question, only to see in the press the next morning the New York headlines: "Bishop's first question, are there massage parlors in New York?" Now, would that all misrepresentation of faith were that innocuous today. Where you are now in the United States, the misrepresentation of faith has been greatly magnified, has become mutual on either side, and is often extremely malicious. And one of the things most hurt is the gospel. Mark Twain remarked after the Civil War that people in the South were chewing tobacco and muttering, "Damn Yankee," in one word. And many secular humanists today say the same thing about fundamentalists saying secular humanism. And of course, the criticism is more than returned. If you look across at the United States from Europe, it's quite clear that the cause of the gospel is not only damaged by the weakness within the church, it's not only damaged by certain people outside the church in the secularist field who providing a powerful veto on the church, is not only limited by the enormous expansion of the bureaucratic state. One of the things which is most crippling it today, both in the States and potentially for the world, is the way that the faith is being fought about, including the contribution by Christians. One Christian extremist wrote recently that anyone who took a middle-of-the-road position, theologically or politically, had a special place reserved for them in hell, and they would fry along with other people in the past like Adlai Stevenson and Eleanor Roosevelt. And of course, those sort of sentiments are easy to find on both sides. But surely the gospel is the loser. And I think you're at a place today in the States, particularly because of the abortion bombings, when there can be a critical reappraisal of the way things are being fought and a careful realignment in terms of the ideals on both sides and the purposes of the First Amendment, but primarily for the sake of the gospel. Let me begin by talking about a critical reappraisal. I believe the bombings of the abortion clinics were a blessing in disguise, because in the extremity of them is an enormous opportunity. Much of the easy condemnation by Christians of the bombing revealed the weakness of some of the Christian case against abortion, as magazines like the New Republic pointed out. Equally, one must say that those who took to the bombings did not do so in any principled Christian way at all. There was no sense of moral civil disobedience behind the stand. They didn't do it, take the rap, and highlight the evil they were talking about by owning up to it. It was a totally different kind of stand. But in the extremity is an opportunity. And in 1985, you're at the marvelous place where you can see that not just one side, but both sides have clearly done things totally against both their ideals and their interests. And now you can see two extremes, not just one. One extreme is obviously the extreme of civility. Because of pluralism in a certain climate over 200 years, pluralism has slowly degenerated into relativism, creating an indifference to truth, so that civility led to Christian words being inoffensive and Christian deeds becoming innocuous. And many of those who are now strident and activist are right. The one extreme is undoubtedly a civility that went too far. On the other hand, clearly what the bombing shows us is the other extreme, of the rhetoric of civil war, and many of them used those words quite deliberately spilling over into violence, so far, fortunately, only against property. But at this stage, you can clearly see the two extremes. On the one hand, civility, militating against the gospel's distinctiveness, and on the other hand, civil war, if it got much more serious. I would say at this stage, you can see both in the church and those who are attacking Christians, that both sides are sinning against their own ideals. One could make the argument either pragmatically, based on irony, or much more on principle, based on ideals. For instance, just merely pragmatically, the lesser argument. What is ironic today is that as you listen to the debate, more and more, there is less and less about principle and substance. I heard Judy Goldsmith debating Jerry Falwell recently in Washington, D.C. She didn't say a single thing in favor of abortion. All she did was enumerate Christian excesses, and that was enough to bring the house down in applause. Incidentally, sadly, he didn't make one single principle argument in return. But you can see more and more the argument and the rhetoric and even the recruiting is now depending on the excesses of the other side. So were it not for fundamentalist excesses, the ACLU in some areas of the country would have gone out of business, and many of the other groups would not even have begun. But far more seriously is not the pragmatic argument, but the principle argument. And you can look at Christian extremists and secularist extremists to see that both sides are offending their own highest ideals. Take our Christian side first. Look over American history in 200 years, and you can see many distinct periods when the gospel is under pressure or Protestantism is under pressure. It is produced from the Protestant Christian community, and one has to say Protestant, sadly. It has produced attitudes that amount to a kind of conservative syndrome. The 1830s, the 1920s, and all of the things that you've seen in the past are alive and well and flourishing today by Christians. Mudslinging, name-calling, guilt by association. One could mention many things, but there are four principally that have always come up and they're alive today. Dependency on conspiracy theories. Nonsensical, paranoid-based conspiracy theories, which are a shame to those who have the assurance and confidence in Christ. You can see it right back to the late 18th century, and it's flourishing today. Secondly, depiction of the battle in Manichaean terms. In other words, the battle is depicted as being the forces of total evil against the forces of total good, which is actually the way a recent Christian law case was put forward. Absolutely unbiblical in terms of theology. We who are Christ take sin with us into the best and most idealistic and most just causes which we fight. And any notion of Manichaeism, that there's no evil on our side, is utterly foolish and bound to disillusion us, let alone be seen by the other side. Thirdly, the denial of free speech. Sadly, in the name of those fighting censorship, fighting a consensus that's keeping us out in places, many Christian activists today are taking to denying free speech and banning books and so on, in a way which is wrong in principle and entirely counterproductive in practice. And fourthly, and most importantly of all, a recurring defamation of personal character. And maybe the saddest case is not just the Christian attacks on non-Christians, sad though some of those have been, but the entirely deliberate, extremely distorted, thoroughly unbiblical attacks by Christians on other brothers and sisters, which is wrong before the Lord and a scandal before a watching world. Surely we're at a place where we've got to say with sadness, the excesses on our Christian side are very obvious. Judged by biblical standards in principle, judged by historical standards in terms of their productiveness, we are making almost every one, if not more, of the classic mistakes that have been made in the past. But of course, it's not only one side. And today's a magnificent moment because we can turn to the other side, who profess to stand for liberalism and for tolerance and many other things like this, and to point out that every one of the charges they make of the Christian extremists, they are now guilty of themselves. And this isn't just a biased thing. Hard, objective studies have been done, say, of the liberal reaction to the fundamentalists. And at every single point where they've made criticism to the fundamentalists, you see that the secularists or the liberals are making exactly those same mistakes today. So you have extreme examples of liberal absolutism, which is almost paradoxical, of liberal intolerance, of liberals who accuse the fundamentalists of being self-righteous, who have extreme examples of it themselves. For example, they often accuse moral majority of expropriating ideals self-righteously just by the name moral majority, as if anyone who didn't agree with them is not moral and so on. But you can see people for the American way in their own arguments often have many instances where people who disagree with them are somehow not for the American way and somehow less American, if not un-American. Or they accuse the fundamentalist extremists of being sensationalist and simplistic. And there is much that is true in that. But you read their literature, and it's absolutely full of similar examples of that very kind. I read one paper just a few weeks ago which talked about a Christian Nazism emerging in the States, where the godly were goose-stepping mercilessly over the godless right across the country. Absolute nonsensical, simplistic sensationalism from a side claiming to attack simplistic sensationalism. And I think we're in a marvelous position today to say with sadness to our own side, but with challenge to the other side, that both sides are conducting this debate against their highest ideals and certainly against the interests of the country. This is a great time for a critical reappraisal, and certainly we must do it in terms of the Christian side. How about the second half of the challenge, though? Time for a careful realignment. In other words, how do we as Christians take part in this debate, but more than that, seek to realign the whole way we take part with our Christian ideals above all, but also with the intentions of the First Amendment? In other words, each stand we make must not only have its own integrity, it must be a living demonstration of that which we're speaking about and that which we're aiming towards. And that's what I think needs to be done today. I'd like just to share with you, and none of this is my business in a way as an Englishman, except it is my business as you look across as a Christian brother and as someone concerned for the state of democracy in the world, I'd like just to share with you what I think are some of the simple prerequisites that Christians here need to reckon on as they make Christian stands in the public sphere. Let me deal with them in reverse. Start with the outer, which is the wrong end, and work back towards the inner. Because in a way, it's this way that we have to justify them in public. Although as we begin, it's from the inner working to the outer. The first thing I think we need to wrestle through is what it means to respect principled pluralism. Principled pluralism. Now here clearly there are two extremes, and we're working towards a biblical third way. One extreme is that we're indifferent to truth, where pluralism leads to relativism that leads to what the 19th century called nothingarianism. That's one extreme, indifference to truth. The other extreme is imposition. If we have the numbers, we have the power, we impose it on anyone over everything. What is a principled pluralism between these? Well, clearly we have no biblical absolute about pluralism. And what I'm giving you is partly based on an Old Testament view of pluralism and partly based on the historical judgment that pluralism, in a principled sense, has given the best freedom for the gospel primarily, but secondarily for democratic citizenship. You can see the situation like this. Look over the world's history and you can see two broad extremes. America has never gone to these extremes, and by God's grace, must never go to them. But we need to see them in our minds. One extreme is the total state. In other words, the exclusion of all faiths because of a state-backed indifference to truth. The total state. Think of Rome, think of the Soviet Union. The other extreme is the total church. The establishment of a particular faith because of the state-backed imposition of faith because of a church-dominated state. Think of Christendom. Now, America has never gone to those extremes, and yet you must say, if we're honest today, that America has had two tendencies which she has gone down, although she's never gone to the extremes, and we're at a good place for seeing the two tendencies. For the first 180 years of American history, the majority tendency has been towards a semi-establishment. And let's not kid ourselves, things like the public schools were virtually Protestant parochial schools. And while there was ostensibly pluralism and ostensibly church-state separation, He was very, very much in favor of Protestantism, and it was not a genuine pluralism, and it is no longer possible today because of the reality on the ground. There was a semi-establishment of Protestantism. In other words, there was effectively a sectarian-based religious establishment. For the last 20 years, though, the tendencies have been in the other direction, for a semi-secularism, a state-backed exclusion of all faiths. Now, again, I stress that America has not gone to the extremes, but you see these two tendencies. And that's, again, why the mid-1980s are such a crucial point, because now, again, we can see what's the error in both ways, and both, for various reasons, are wrong and unwise. Which means that today we surely should be arguing neither for establishment or semi-establishment, and certainly not for the exclusion of all faiths and the exclusion of religious faiths, but for the expansion of a genuine pluralism at this particular moment. Or to put it differently, we're arguing not for a restoration of the past, nor for a repudiation of religion in the present, but a genuine realignment that gives a freedom to all in the light of the intentions of the First Amendment. Now that means that for secular people, we're calling them to give up the first tendencies towards the total state which have begun to emerge in the last 20 years. The strict separation they speak about, the total neutrality. And there are any number of myths on the secular side, like the dead metaphor of the wall of separation and so on. We're asking them to give up these first tendencies towards the total church, which have begun in the last 20 years. At the same time, though, surely, we have to publicly give up the last trappings of what remains of semi-establishment. And those Christians who are still calling for theocracy, or for what's technically known in quotes as Christian America, are calling for the last trappings of a semi-establishment which in the present situation is both wrong and extremely unwise. In other words, you're at a crucial turning point where you could have for the first time the genuine establishment of true pluralism and a true faith-freedom balance. How then would I see, as a European, the sort of situation you might have as the First Amendment originally intended it and you might have it today? Well, you could put it in a number of ways. On the one hand, vis-a-vis the churches and the synagogue, the state is the guarantor of the political preconditions of freedom. On the other hand, vis-a-vis the state, the churches and the synagogues are the generators of the spiritual preconditions for faith and freedom. So the state provides the safeguard of freedom for faith, and the churches and the synagogue provide the source of faith for freedom. And if that balance is genuinely achieved, and it needs realigning today because the First Amendment has been lost in terms of its genius, you have something that really gives a genuine freedom for faith and yet allows faith to be the genuine source of freedom. Which means that legally, church and state are separated. But functionally, they're closely related. So you have the possibility of both a critical and a constructive relationship, which is surely the best for the gospel, as well as very much the best for democracy. Now, for that to happen, certain things need to be in place. One of them is simply that Christians need to be very clear as they enter the public debate what they're calling for. So we need to make clear on the one hand where we're saying we, within a society we consider as living to a lower law, we will live by our higher law regardless of what you do. The tragedy is today in many areas where we profess to live to a higher law, the hard statistics show that we are actually living to the same lower law as everyone else. Areas like divorce, lying, cheating, and so on. The incidence of Christian things in these areas is almost as high as the incidence of non-Christian things. So on the one hand, we have to agree, in a society we consider as living to a lower law, we will live to our higher law regardless of how anyone else lives. On the other hand, we must say, without any squeamishness, there are certain areas where we will impose. The word imposition has become a bad word today, but let's make no nonsense about it. All great reforms have been essentially imposition. the abolition of slavery. They were essentially legal reforms that were imposition against the tide of tradition and history in the name of higher reform. We are not against imposition, rightly understood. But we have to define where it is. In other words, in the areas of civil rights, where that becomes crucially important, as in slavery, as in abortion, in these areas we are absolutely unsqueamish about using the word imposition because of civil rights and the desire to reform. But of course that leaves a large area between the imposition and the areas where we're living to our higher law within a society with a lower law. And surely our general approach in this middle area is that with persuasion, seeking to win people through argument and lifestyle and practice, we want to shape, as we can, more and more of the society towards the shape of the second half of the Ten Commandments, but by persuasion in many other ways. So there's the first thing, principle pluralism, standing for it carefully and sensitively, showing what we're aiming for, so that the very things we say as well as what we do are a model and a mirror of what we're aiming for. The first point then, principled persuasion. Principled pluralism. The second key point, and this one is biblically grounded in a much stronger sense, is principled penetration. Principled penetration. What do I mean? Well, here again you can see two extremes that are wrong. On the one hand, you have the old extreme, which is technically known as privatization. Faith is allowed to be privately engaging, socially irrelevant. Now, theologically, that was always wrong. But socially, we happened to get away with it until the mid-60s when the consensus collapsed. And that's why as late as 1960s, Catholics like John Kennedy were calling for strict separation. And as late as 1965, the old model, Falwell, was attacking ministers who got involved in politics. Although their faith was privatized, when the consensus was in place, the consensus covered for the public irrelevance of the Christian faith. That is no longer true. Privatization today is a betrayal of the gospel, and it's socially disastrous. But many Christians have now swung to the opposite extreme. Well, not quite the opposite, but an extreme which has dangers in it, which is politicization. Thinking that the answer to privatization is to politicize the gospel. And for evangelicals to do this, which is the main ones who are doing it today, is surely a cardinal error in any number of ways. But above all, for a very simple reason. It is missing the main point, which is to recover the penetration of discipleship in every area of every believer's life. Only for politicians is politics the total vocation. And even for them it's not, because they're also fathers and so on. But for most people to think that politics is the main arena of Christian influence is a terrible mistake theologically and socially. The real challenge is for Christians to make Christ the Lord of every inch of their lives, where they are in industry, in medicine, in law, in education, and so on. And people are getting all caught up and preoccupied with politics are unwittingly politicizing the gospel. What's the alternative then? Principle penetration. It's no accident that the symbols of faith, salt, light, yeast, they're all symbols of penetration, of infiltration, and subversion. And Christians have never been more powerful in any society than whether they practiced this principle and never claimed any more space, socially speaking, than they have filled and occupied and filled out for Christ. In other words, when we not only have Christian personnel in place, but when they are thinking Christianly and acting Christianly, and then penetration goes on. I say that because one of the great dangers today is the politics of symbol. Listen to so much Christian influence in public. For instance, the creche issue, or the school prayer issue, or tacking on references about secular humanism. Now, many of the Christian leaders are quite openly going for what they call the politics of symbol. This will show how powerful we still are. Much of this is theologically wrong-headed. We are not after symbol. Nothing in Scripture talks about symbol. Symbol comes from a highly anonymous society which gives such a place to advertising and therefore puts an enormous show in credibility and outward symbol. Whereas the gospel is always about inner strength and what is secretly right and good and strong in the secret place before the Lord. If we win the battle, say of Christmas creches or whatever, All we do very often is either secularize our Christian symbols. So yes, we're allowed the creche out there because it's now a Christian, it's not a Christian symbol, rather, it's a commercial thing for Christmas. We either secularize the symbol or we scandalize the non-Christian. And either way, we have not penetrated society as salt and light for the gospel. Principle penetration. Much Christian activism in politics today is missing the point and doing the wrong things because it is betraying the gospel's challenge to principled penetration. A third thing that needs to be considered, principled persuasion. And here the extremes are on the one hand capitulating to other people's ideas, and on the other hand coercing them through sheer power to our ideas. In the scriptures we have the whole notion of principled persuasion. Go back to the Puritans. They had an enormous sense of God's covenant, of Christian community, but one of the three great pillars of the Puritan society was consent. Why? Trust in God was uncoercible. Therefore, consent had to be voluntary. Therefore, they persuaded people. And in their politics, they had a phrase of what they called tarrying for the magistrate. You didn't use law to do what you hadn't first persuaded people to do by the power of the gospel through the word and the spirit. Now today again we're reversing things. And the tragedy is that for many years we've lost persuasion in our evangelism. The liberals don't persuade. Don't defend the gospel, just dialogue. And they usually end up with the other people. Many conservatives though don't persuade either. Don't persuade, proclaim. And so in most evangelism and apologetics, persuasion has been lost for a generation. And now in the States, you are reaping the political consequences of that. With the collapse of the consensus in the nation, you have an unholy trio. Irreconcilable differences, all the single issue groups and so on. Irreconcilable differences, all making insistent demands. You won't see the light, we'll make you feel the heat. And at the end of the day, you have an unsettlable debate. And this is part of the chaos of your public discourse, which is undermining not only the integrity of the gospel, but is undermining the integrity of the American Republic. And Christian persuasion has both democratic consequences as well as spiritual ones. In other words, there are Christians out today who are attacking, rightly, the relativism of sociological law, that 51% say this and so on. That's wrong. And they're right about that. And yet they themselves are relying on king numbers and the sheer power of force to do that which they are not persuading people to do, first of all by lifestyle, secondly by Christian proclamation and persuasion that wins people in a way that is true to the gospel itself. So you can see people taking the forms of power that are a long way from the real power of the gospel. And one of the great dilemmas of America today is that the power of polemics is outrunning the power of the gospel. And every time that's been done in the past, the gospel is the loser. One last thing that needs to be considered, principled penitence. Principled penitence. Again, penitence has a bad word because in the liberals in the 60s, many people were confessing anything and everything all the time. And you had this sort of parading of sins all the time when we were all guilty for everything, which is quite extraordinary. But we're in a different age now. And you can see that many evangelicals have swung from the old danger, which is a kind of public timidity, to a new danger, which is a kind of public truculence. And I've heard many Christian statesmen making statements in public that really were extremely truculent, about now we're in the candy store and you're not going to get the candy out of our hands. That statement actually made in a public meeting in New York by one of the fundamentalist leaders. Now this, whether it's the timidity on one side or the truculence of the other, is surely not mirroring the way Christians begin in their heart. And by principled penitence, I simply mean what Martin Luther meant, that we know that at one and the same moment we are always sinners, always penitent, always justified, always sinners, and so on. But that note of realism runs through all our actions. The very things we fight against, we know in our own hearts. And we are not Manichaeans. We are not idealists. We are Christian realists who begin with knowing that the problem starts in our hearts, and we carry that problem wherever we go, whatever we do, and there should be a penitence in our attitude, which both frees us from timidity, because as Christ forgives us, we are holy in our boldness, and yet allows us to be bold without being truculent. Because in our boldness, we have a deep sense of penitence before God, because we know our own hearts. Look over world history, and it's quite clear that the beginning of all freedom is rooted in the proper recognition of religious freedom. Christians have sinned against this as much as any religious group in history, but thank God, too, Christians have shown a different way, far more than most religious groups, probably than more all other religious groups in history. You are citizens of the country, which is the heir of that. Much of the genius of the First Amendment has allowed faith and freedom to flourish in this country as in probably no other country in history. And yet today, that balance has been unhinged. And the way Christians are fighting to put it right is actually, in many cases, making the balance worse, both for the gospel and for the nation. I think America stands in relation to the world today at the most extraordinary place, strategically. You could say that, religiously speaking, America stands between the Third World and Europe. Like Europe, America has been modernized. But unlike Europe, America is deeply spiritual. Like the Third World, America has religion in general, but the Christian faith in particular, flourishing. But unlike the Third World, America is modernized. And America is both religious and modern, and stands in this crucial mediating place between Europe and the Third World. So religiously speaking, America should be and could be key to so much of what's happening strategically in the next 20 years. But you could make the same point politically. The world is increasingly being polarized between, on the one hand, highly secular universalistic ideologies, such as Marxism, and on the other hand, highly particularistic religious fanaticisms, such as Shiite fundamentalism in Iran. In other words, total states and total churches. And in this situation, with all my heart, I believe that you alone have, under God, the political way that shows the way through. So faith and freedom are inextricably linked for the world. And what provides the best freedom for faith also provides the only faith for true freedom. So what you do is significant for America. It's significant for the world, but it's also, of course, primarily what matters crucially for the gospel. Many people point out that Abraham Lincoln called America the last best hope of the earth, and as Christians, we can't subscribe to that, because nothing short of the second coming is worthy of that description. Christ alone is the last best hope of this earth. But having said that, one can understand what Lincoln meant. And I believe that the way you take the lead in your churches, and this is multiplied across the nation, is key to faith and freedom in America and potentially for the whole world. Civility or civil war? This is the moment to show a genuinely Christian way.